This is The Mary Davis Show, a program that takes an inside look at what is happening in Western New York with interviews, news, special features, and the community calendar. Now, here is your host, Mary Davis.
Good morning and welcome. I'm your host, Mary Davis, and it's my great privilege this morning to have a returning guest who's been with me many times. He's based in New York City, and his name is Jarvis Tiner, and he is a vice chair, I believe, of the New York State Communist Party. Is that correct, Jarvis?
You never get it right.
The chair?
Because it's changed. I was national executive vice chair, but now I'm now chair of New York, which I used to do years ago.
He's now the chair of New York. I'm sorry, Jarvis, but I have the great privilege of having him one-on-one discussion, and it always promises to be good because Jarvis always knows what he talks about, even if I sometimes don't agree, and I do disagree from time to time. But I like the way he brings things up. And just to warn you today, I have a fairly large calendar. So Jarvis and I will be on about 50 minutes instead of 58. So we'll be on about 50 minutes today. So I can tell everybody what's going on in the city. In case Jarvis doesn't always mention this, here, this must be a bit older, Jarvis, because what I'm reading of your bio right now is Jarvis Tiner is Executive Vice Chair of the Communist Party USA. And a longtime member of the party's national board. He was a founding member of the Black Radical Congress and served on its National Coordinating Committee for 5 years. He was born in Mill Creek community. He's born in the Mill Creek community of West Philadelphia in 1941. And graduated from West Philadelphia High School. He joined the Communist Party USA at the age of 20, so he's been around in that party for a long time. And after several years working in various industrial jobs in the Philadelphia area, where he was a member of the Amalgamated Lithographer, am I getting that right? And the Teamsters Union. And he, as the leader of the CPUSA, Tiner has been an active public spokesperson against racism, imperialism, and war. He has written numerous articles and pamphlets and appears on the media, campuses, and in other public venues advocating for peace, equality, and the socialist alternative. Is that pretty good?
Yeah, but it's just out of date. I mean, I'm no longer National Executive Vice Chair. And as I said, I'm now chair of the state of New York, and I'm sort of the elder statesman around here, and treat me nice though.
How does that sound? How does that ring, elder statesman? Does that make you feel very important with a long white beard?
It sounds like you don't have to do a lot of work. That's what
like stuffing envelopes and going door to door.
Well, no, maybe you know, one morning you get up and say, look, I can't get into that meeting. I'll call you on the phone, you know.
That kind of thing, huh?
Understand. Now that I have a couple of grandchildren, everybody understands.
Uh-huh.
You have things to do.
Yeah, we can always plead the grandchildren bit.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing, I know, of course, you've been heard all about the train crash, but you know the one thing that came out of me, and it reminded me so much of Baltimore, like the same thing that's been going on here in Buffalo, is one section of our city, and I know you're going to be in Buffalo sometime next month, mm-hmm. And I hope you get to see, and if not, I'll certainly drive you around through there, and that's the Fruit Belt area. And it is amazing what they're doing. Black people in that have been living in that area since the 40s, 30s, 40s. And they're really trying to move them out. They're expanding a large university and hospital campus there, I should say. And what they're really trying to do is just take the community out from under the people that live there. Or as some people said at a meeting I attended on Tuesday, is move black faces out and put white faces in. And it was more blunt than I've ever heard. And there were almost 100 people at this meeting, which is really unusual for like a little community meeting. And it was saying that, you know, black people are waking up to this and be starting to organize to fight back. And so I hope you get to see that community when you're here next month, because I certainly would not mind driving you around through there.
No, I'd like to see it very much. And see, it's connected also to this police violence thing, you know.
It is. All of it is quite connected.
And the criminalization of the people who now live there. And if you take an average, you know, a black or Latino working class family, they depend on everybody bringing a little bit in to help to meet ends
because
of the low wages that we generally are saddled with.
Mm-hmm.
And when they arrest a kid on marijuana, or stop and frisk, or some other minor infraction,
it takes money.
You know, you can have a joint, but if you show it, take it out publicly,
mm-hmm.
it is an offense, and you can be arrested for that.
And your family's going to have to pay. They're going to have to usually pay for some kind of lawyer or some other kind of fees.
And then if they end up in jail, that is a big piece of the family income.
A big piece, yeah.
Comes in. And then when they come out, they got a wreck and they can't work. So guess what the family got? You got to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so after a while, they can't live.
They
can't make it in the neighborhood.
Mm-mm.
And along comes these speculators. The rents are going up every month and everything. Mm-hmm. And then the speculators come in and they want to buy this and that area and so on. When they're evicting people and they're neglecting properties they own so that they can convert them. It's
terrible. Well, last night, one thing at that meeting, because my house is not too far from Fruit Belt. I couldn't walk there, but it's fairly close, you know, geographically speaking. And the one of the speakers was saying, whatever you do, don't sell your house. Stay in your home or either make sure you leave it to some other relative. But don't give up your home because that's what they want to do.
And watch those reverse mortgages.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because that's what you're doing with that one.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I never really understood reverse mortgages, but I never bought into one.
Yeah, well, I guess there's different kinds around everything, but basically they give you money based on the equity in your house, but when you die, your house is theirs.
Your house is theirs, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is what, I don't know, I just never went into it.
You don't have to worry about that mortgage. It's gone. It's out of your life.
Mm-hmm.
But we've taken your house.
But we've taken your house, yeah. And that's what they were busy saying last night. Whatever you do, watch, don't let anything get near you where there's going to be something that they could take over your house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we're talking about that. But I think the one thing that really sparked my interest about, because this is not my community or my neighborhood, so to speak, but it abuts mine. And I was thinking about it because it reminded me of the facts that were coming out of Baltimore. And along with what they were saying about Baltimore, and that was the condition of the neighbors, which is almost the same thing that's happening in Buffalo. And as one speaker said, all over the United States. And that is like the communities in Baltimore who had been dilapidated and not repaired or not built up and just left to just go. Ever since the assassination of Martin Luther King, you know, just there and just gone. This was like in Baltimore, they were showing the neighborhoods and people were getting so frustrated with them that it just couldn't happen. There were no jobs in the neighborhood and there was really no transportation to get out to where the jobs were. And it's basically, it's almost the same thing, identical, that's happening in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently when you talked about Harlem, that happened in New York City.
Yeah, well, you know, back in the day, we used to call it urban renewal.
Yeah, well, I know what they were saying about it now.
Hometown Philadelphia back in the day,
we
called it Negro removal.
That's so true. Mm-hmm.
And they basically took an area adjacent to Center City, which is the main downtown area, for all the big money investments and large corporations.
Yeah, well, that's where most poor people had lived in Buffalo.
We
probably
lived right adjacent to that, and they were very run-down. Single family, sort of row houses. Man, they took that thing, moved all those people out on Lombard Street, South Street, all these, and turned them into modern, now they are townhouses.
Houses, yeah.
Yeah.
Where you could never afford to live in.
Move back in, you know. And, you know, they built the highways to go out to from the subways and back so that people could get out of the city. Now they coming back into the city.
Mm-hmm. They want the city back.
They don't want to spend all that money on gas and, and all the other problems that are out there.
And the idea is to move blacks out.
Yeah.
And this is because you can even see ads in our local newspaper. The near suburbs to Buffalo right now are like Chickawauga, some parts of Amherst, and parts of Amherst that really abut the city. Chickawauga, certainly, which is probably the poor of those suburbs. Not so much Lancaster, but these are just some of the ones that abut really close, Williamsville, the city line. And there's all sorts of ads in the paper you never saw before about senior citizen housing, other projects going up, you know, when encouraging people that live in the city to move there. So you're suddenly looking around and all the, you know, most of the poor people, mostly Black and Latino, are encouraged to move to Chickawauga out of the city of Buffalo because most of the whites, particularly the white professionals, want to move back into the city to be near where all this new jobs and things are going up. Unfortunately, you know, Black people sitting on the land.
Yeah. Yeah. So get off our land. We want it back.
We want it back, yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course, it belonged to the Indians first. But anyway,
yeah, this is so true. You know, that outward, before it was that migration, most white people were running out to the suburbs, and now they want to run back to the city. But it's all these Black people living there, and they got to go someplace.
And then there's an economic incentive for the big real estate companies and the, you know, the people that do all the
speculators and developers.
Speculators, yeah. Because, you know, they don't make much money when the property stays as it is.
Mm-hmm.
They can create a whole turnover.
Mm-hmm.
They make their big money. The banks make it. The real estate people make it. So there's a whole show on television now about these two or three real estate brokers here in New York who only do million-dollar properties. And it is shocking what people are paying for.
And old-fashioned redlining is coming back in vogue.
Yeah.
It's plain old-fashioned redlining. And it really just, it was just picking me. It just kind of shocked to me, and it shouldn't be, because I should be far more in tune of what's going on in my city. I live here. And I did get up to say some things. And what amazed me was there was only one politician there, and she has been on the show with you before. Her name was Betty Jean Grant. Because she's been on the show with you several times. You may not remember the name, but she has been a guest when you were on many times. And the one thing she said and spoke, she was telling people again about not, you know, stay in your homes, don't sell your house. But the other thing that struck me, where this meeting was taking place, and she's in the Erie County Legislature, so she's not a city politician, but a county one. She was the only politician at this particular meeting which wasn't even in her district. And the people who had facilitated the meeting got up and said, she is so concerned about other people living in the different community, she's the only one that came in. What really got me was that district is also represented by African-American a council member, city council member, and many of the abutting districts that are represented by African Americans. Not one was there. There was no representative from the mayor. And this was a major, this meeting in this particular time was so important, so important. Nearly 100 people showed up, and over 100 the last meeting that they called on this, which is telling me that there is an awful lot of interest here. And it struck me, the people in it was a very mixed crowd, white and Black people there that live in or around that neighborhood is worrying about their own property, was saying to me, most of those people there looked to me and acted like they were solid voters, people who were rather active or interested in what's going on. And I couldn't understand why they think that they could simply ignore all those people. And it was a pointed reference made to the fact of why there were no representatives other than Betty Jean Grant, who was at this particular meeting, or the one previous to that. And I did get up and I did make a remark, because one of the guests on the that was there, newspaper reporter, Buffalo newspaper reporter, spoke to me, recognized one, because he's also been on my show twice. And some of the remarks he said in a column he wrote, which I read last week, and he was saying that you could see who was not there, and he talked something about the speculative piece, and also the politicians that were bought and paid for. And I thought that was kind of remarkable. You know, that this is getting out. There was not a representative from the mayor's office, nor the mayor. There was not a representative, as I said before, from any politician. And when I got up and I made my remark that I had to say, I said, what is astounding to me as I look around this room and there are no public officials who represent this district or any other district on the east side, primarily where African Americans live. I said, yet none who would need to get votes from the east side, particularly every black politician in Buffalo, is elected on the backs of black and brown people, every last one of them, including the mayor. And then someone else said to me, said, well, see how they marginalize you. He said, people look around and say, oh, there's no public officials here, so this must not be important. He said, and that's how they work it, because they want to make you feel that you're attending a meeting that is of no importance.
And what was the
by ignoring you.
Again?
Hmm?
What was the purpose of that meeting again?
The purpose of that meeting was to talk about gentrification and right. what is happening in this district. And as one person got up and said, their plan is, if you look at their plan, he had it all on like a brought in his computer that he could put where you could see the stuff on a large wall. And he said, they're going to take over the entire east side where most black people live. And they're going to gentrify this whole thing. And all of you are going to be out. Because they will probably use eminent domain for those that don't want to sell to say they need the property. And he talked about there's a law, I think, SNAFU or SNUFU or something like that. I probably haven't got it right because I didn't write it down. But it had to say that before you could start land grabbing, you had to do this search, and you had to give justification for have you done an environmental impact study before you can do any of that. He said, and so far in no cities that you can name, certainly not in Buffalo, have they done that. They've just more or less told the federal government to go to hell.
Right.
He said, and they're aided and abetted by local politicians.
Well, most of the first thing is these real estate speculator types, and the banks are involved in it, and big,
the redlining
hedge funds and all these other, you know, super billion-dollar corporate power.
Mm-hmm.
They're all involved. The first thing they do is buy out the politicians.
Mm-hmm.
They give not on everything, you know. Oh, you mm-hmm. want to be anti-racist? All it's okay. Just don't mess with this issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So there are people who I highly respect and who've been fighting on those certain issues, but they're scared
mm-hmm.
when some developer come knock on the door and say, look, I want to build a luxury
mm-hmm.
Housing unit in your district.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to bring a good element in here.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have raise the taxes better.
Mm-hmm.
They talk to people college educated and you know all these mm-hmm. all these things, and it's going to be better for you. And by the way, we're dropping $10,000 in the house
mm-hmm.
in the hat for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of hard for a politician
to say no.
A highly principled person to say no. It's like, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's like if you're, you know, a preacher trying to run a little church, and along comes somebody and give them a lot of money to do this, that, and the other.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they get involved in real estate, too.
Mm-hmm.
And there used to be this Jeremiah program,
mm-hmm.
which is bought, you know, and then rented out, so forth. But they are letting that go. They don't feel it's in their interest to
mm-hmm.
that. But you know who can buck it? The small homeowners.
Yes.
The renters.
Yes.
The
they mentioned that too about renters.
And low paid workers who are struggling to stay.
Mm-hmm.
That's the majority.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. They're the voters. You made that point. And they got to organize. I'm going to tell you one thing that's going on here in New York, real quick.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, right now, down at Foley Square, down in the federal court area of Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
there's a demonstration going to be forming this evening to discuss, to go after the issue of real rent reform. Because, you know, most New Yorkers are renters.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to fight gentrification, you got to fight what the landlords are doing
mm-hmm.
to inflate the rents, to make housing unaffordable
mm-hmm.
for most people. Now, when Bill de Blasio came in, and he's kind of stuck to his guns on this, although we hope that he'll do much, much more.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was going to build 40,000 units of affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the issue of affordable is a really big controversy, because what's affordable for some people ain't affordable for others.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But when they make these deals that, okay, you can build, 600 units in this thing here, but you have to set aside, 25 for moderate-income people. And then the moderate-income people end up to be people who, in order to pay the rent, would have to make a substantial salary. Mm-hmm. It's not aiding poor people. In a sense, so you got to fight on that. But he said he was going to build 40,000, and he has actually done some.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually worked that out. He said we have it. He called it a tale of two cities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is something that politicians in New York have raised on many occasions and over the years, that we have a very, very rich class and a very, very poor class.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a result of the economics.
Mm-hmm.
This big city we live in, and the drive for super profits on the part of the corporations, and the drive of employers to keep the wages down, including public workers' wages.
Mm-hmm.
So you have growing poverty and growing wealth side by side, but the poor people, there are a lot more of them than the rich people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of rich people, though they live in the city, a lot of them still live out in the suburbs and just make their money here.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to do something like that. And right now, there's a coalition called Real Rent Reform Coalition, I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And it includes like 1199 Hospital Workers, SEIU,
mm-hmm.
and New York Community for Change, which is a labor-sponsored community organizing. And they have a whole new alliance, mm-hmm. called the Alliance for Tenant Power.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be demonstrating and fighting to really hold back the rents from continuing rising beyond the means of most people,
mm-hmm.
and to get some form of new housing, decent housing,
mm-hmm.
but affordable housing. If they can take these old rundown houses, modernize them, make them beautiful townhouses and so forth,
mm-hmm.
and for rich people, they could do it for poor people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They could do it for poor people. We pay taxes, and I think part of our right as taxpayers and as people who live in this city,
mm-hmm.
is to be able to survive,
mm-hmm.
be able to have the means to survive and raise your family and have a decent life. And if wages won't do it, and they don't do it, they increasingly don't do it, they're holding wages down, I think the city ought to take our tax money and provide services that private sector is not doing.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with that?
Not a thing. Not a darn thing.
That would be heresy in some circles to say.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah.
But this is the way I think our country's got to head.
Mm-hmm. But, it's getting to the point, and I think one of the things that they kept talking about that, again, struck me as interesting was when they talked about the infrastructure in this country. And there was this one guy, he's head of something near New York, the head of the transportation something in New York City, or the...
the Metropolitan, what do they call it? The
Metropolitan, I think, yeah.
Yeah, it's... I know what you're talking about. The people that run the World Trade Center, and they run the...
Well, he was making some comparisons between our country, the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
and the roads and the railroads and things in Japan, in Germany, and in mm-hmm. England. And he was talking about, my God, how they run, and how they're one of their big interests and priorities is the country's infrastructure. And here, he just mentioned on the same date of that big train derailment, the U.S. Congress, or rather the House of Representatives, which is controlled by the Republicans along a party vote, voted to trim again the budget for Amtrak.
Yeah,
and he was talking about, the conditions on the roadbeds for these trains is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them haven't been repaired in a while. It's the same with infrastructure. All of them, he was talking about, bridges in this country falling down, sewer systems falling down. And yet the main thing that, and these are my words, not his, but it seemed to me the only thing that Republicans and conservatives are interested in is raising the hue and cry over tax breaks.
Yeah. Well, one of the things they're arguing when the Republicans anyway, arguing when they cut the subsidy to Amtrak was you shouldn't be able to, you shouldn't say that this accident had anything to do with the subsidies for Amtrak. Because what Barbara said, you know, we have to really modernize the whole transportation grid. You know, we got to get to high-speed trains that, in fact, could cut travel time. And
You can't run these high-speed trains on the rails that they have. I mean, not when these rails are used by freight trains, too, and then try to run these type of high-speed trains on these same tracks.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Why does... there's a system now that will slow down trains.
Yes, you just do automatically.
On the whole grid of, you know, the whole Amtrak grid on the Northeast. We don't have that. We should be everywhere.
It should be, yeah.
With a curve like that, that requires that trains that everybody wants to be on time and they're quick. You know,
but you want to get there alive, too.
100 miles an hour. So, yeah, you would think that they would have that fixed.
Because,
you know, this is the second train accident we had on Metro North, which goes from the city into the suburbs. On Metro North, there was an accident about a year and a half, 2 years ago, where, again, in this case, the driver of the train, who I distinctly remember his name was Rockefeller, but I don't think he was associated with the family. They don't have too many train drivers in that family. But anyway, he...
Wasn't that the one that either hit an SUV or something like that?
You have to make, just as you're entering the Bronx and heading downtown, it's right near the Hudson River. And instead of slowing down, he fell asleep. And the train went off thing and almost ended up in the river. And four people got killed. And, again, no automatic system that would slow down a train. You know, you have it in the New York subways. If they go through a red light, boom, this thing automatically trips something and slows the train down so that you don't have a rear-end collision, you know. But apparently they don't have that everywhere they should have it on the whole metro.
How many hours are these workers working? It could be something in the working condition. Because why should, if a worker is working a normal, say, 8-hour day, like we're supposed to be working with a half hour or hour for lunch, why are they sleeping on the job?
Yeah. Well, they work strange hours and they do swing shifts and they really have a tough day. I know some people work for the railroad and they'll tell you, you know. Sometimes you're lucky if you can get 5 hours sleep at a night and to make another shift, you don't, you know.
Good
and
grief.
It's a tough thing, and that shouldn't be allowed.
That's kind of like what doctors who were just young interns would be working, all kinds of crazy hours.
Doing operations.
Yeah,
and stuff.
On 2 hours worth of sleep.
So what did they say then? They said then, so it's you're throwing good money after bad to give money to Metro, to Amtrak, keep saying Metro, Amtrak. And this is not a case for money, for needing more money. This is a case for, as one caller I heard on one show say, this is really a case of the criminality of the engineer, the operator of the train. That's what you do. Now, criminality means he intended
to do that.
It's
kind of like that the Indian pilot in that last one where he deliberately drove into the Himalayan mountains.
Right.
You know, he was suicidal. As far as I was concerned with him, if he wanted to take his life, fine. But why'd he have to take everybody else with him?
Absolutely. But you know what else? They have this thing where you can lock the door. So you can't get in. And so the pilot was banging on the door trying to get in and take over, especially as the plane began to descend. And when... And the guy wouldn't open the door. So I heard an expert on television say, you know, all he had to do was go in the bathroom. He could kick that door in and buy the thing. But apparently nobody knew it. And now everybody knows it.
Yeah, everybody knows it. Yeah.
So the pilot couldn't get in. He locked the door. And all this panic about, you know, security. They didn't even allow the pilot to have a little key so he can get back in.
So he can get back in.
And that could have saved a lot of lives.
Well, there should have been maybe three people in that cockpit at all times. So if one did go, there'd be two others sitting in it. And maybe both of them, or maybe one, if the other person had been in it, maybe he didn't want to go that day. You know, he might have wanted to live another day.
What happens, how does a pilot reach... You know, Denzel did that movie about the pilot who had an alcohol problem. The name of it. Did you see it?
No, I did not, but I heard about it.
Yeah, and he confessed that he had been drinking, and he had this problem, and it was his fault and so forth. But what happened was that these pilots should be under some form, and these, you know, I generally think, and even that they make sure they get enough sleep and that they make sure they're not under any influence of alcohol or whatever that would impair their abilities to perform.
Don't I know now that they force these hospitals to not work interns? Like, interns have to work all kinds of hours, while the big shot doctors, you know, could take off for the week and whatever else, and have these interns, you know, if you want to be a doctor, that's what you're going to have to work, working 15 and 20 hours every day. You know,
like
with
a rite of passage, though, you have to suffer.
You have to suffer, in order to become, once you have, you know, paid your way, so to speak, you know, you might be half dead by then, assuming you survive, or that your patients survive. You know, then you can become, have the great privilege of becoming a doctor. And that's really sad. But I think that they really brought this out, I think, in Baltimore. Despite what you hear all over, say, like Fox News, you know, the thugs are doing this, the thugs are doing that. And I'm saying this is the new N-word. You know, thugs, that's just sort of taking over this new thing. And again, you know, it, somebody else was saying this, and they say I talk about it too much, but I don't think that I do. I just often have to wonder sometimes, what would the majority, current majority in the United States be? And we're talking about demographics, population. If suddenly all, every single African-American was removed from the United States and went to live someplace else, who would they hate?
Well, there's a large number of Latinos.
So they would be the new, they'd be the new thugs.
And, you know, immigrants. But we have historically been the source of the great hate machine of the system, in that that has been used to divide and rule working people, hold us down, and keep white workers with low wages down lower because ours are even lower. And to use, well, at least you're not integrated with them. You could, you know, you could be happy the way you are. You'd be like them, or the, you know, that kind of.
Well, no, at least you have a white skin, and that makes you better than the rest. It puts you step up above,
Really, and it'll increase the bottom line. At least that's the prevailing view in corporate circles. But in the real world, we'd be a lot richer country if there was racial equality and justice, and all the talent, all the potential of young people wasted away because they were racially profiled in school and sent to the, you know, the lowest level of education was given to them. And then when they got older, they were criminalized, end up in prison. I mean, you know, that had not, was not the structural racism that we face every day in this country. If that wasn't there, we'd have, this would be a wonderful nation in terms of economic justice, equality, and peace, and racial harmony, and just plain humanism. We would be wonderful, because we're one of the most integrated countries in the world, you know.
You know what they say, though, about integration? And they said, why, that they don't have these things like in Finland and Norway and Sweden, because the population is homogeneous. And why there's always this discord. Now, this is, I'm taking a devil's advocate kind of thing. It's only this much discord in here because there's so many different colored people. There's too many people of different backgrounds, and that's not the same like in Norway, Denmark, Sweden, and, you know, and the Scandinavian countries.
Well, if you go to those countries, and there are some non-white people living there, and in fact now with all the migration from Africa, whose economic circumstances are unbearable, really, people are risking their lives, like Mexicans coming up here and other people from Latin America coming up here, risking their lives, the economy is so bad. And in this case, Africans coming up to Europe and settling in and trying to find a new way to send money home to their family so they can survive, they have their problems too. Although I think the racial oppression, if you travel to those countries, the racial attitudes and so forth are not as vicious and, you know, is not as aggressive and structural and not so much a part of life as it is in our country, but it's there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there.
It's just not as prevalent.
But that notion is a racist notion, that only people who are pure in their whiteness can be intelligent and run a civil society.
Mm-hmm.
BS, excuse the expression.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we're dealing with is a system run for profits and not people in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And the race issue is a byproduct that they use to, in fact, enhance their wealth and influence and power and to hold their power and so forth. And they're trying to prettify it or to make it acceptable by saying, well, people are biologically inferior, so they are mm-hmm. never going to reach. And that's nonsense. There's just millions and millions of tens of millions of examples why that is not true.
Mm-hmm.
And every scientist who's ever studied will tell you that we are basically the same,
mm-hmm.
90% the same, And they all have the same brain power, among all races and nationalities.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who are very, very smart and some who are not so smart. But, you create a society where everybody can contribute and feel treated fairly. And to me, if you can't do that, that's a failure of the system, not a failure of the people.
Mm-hmm. And this is what we face quite a bit all the time. What do you think now about this, all of this coming out about misbehaving police? But I don't think it shocked many people. I think the only thing that's shocking to most people, particularly most white people, who don't see the police the same way that African Americans or Latino people or even Native American people see white people. There's totally, because most white people, out of fault, think the police are honorable and don't do any of these things. That it's only, like I see every time I look at the commentary page in Buffalo News, and many whites who write, well, if they obeyed the law and did what they told, they wouldn't get shot. That's not an attitude that most people of color have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, actually, de Blasio made that kind of statement recently. I was surprised, but not,
Mm-hmm. I would be surprised at him, too.
He said if you obey the police.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for crazy, if people insulting you and assaulting you.
Well, what did this 12-year-old boy in Cleveland do that was shot? He was 12 years old playing in a park right across from his house with a little toy gun. What did he not do? First of all, 12 years old, he barely understand what the police were talking about.
Mm. And, well, even Michael Brown was down on his knees with his hands up, don't shoot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He was killed. He was mm-hmm. telling the cop, here, you got me.
Mm-hmm.
No, and the guy who ran from the cop,
yeah,
shot him 8 times
in the back,
in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
He shot him 8 times in the back, running
mm-hmm.
away.
Mm-hmm.
Shoot him in the leg for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Had to kill him and then try to pretend like he accidentally picked up his, the guy took his
taser,
and was running with it.
Mm-hmm.
First case of stealing a taser off a cop I ever heard of, but it's possible to happen, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But he said he took the taser,
mm-hmm.
so he had to shoot him, and then he went and got the taser and put it down.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
What happened there?
The young man there
mm-hmm.
who was filming it all on his phone.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, this is what I was mentioning earlier. This is the big change. Now, mm-hmm. these things have been going on, God knows, for years. But you never could, because no word was ever good enough against the cops. And most jurors are always all white. Usually they're all white juries. They're never really like equally mixed juries or anything like that. They're generally all white juries. And again, as I said before, most white people, and it's not they're evil white people, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that their situations are so different than a person of color's relationship is. Most police who are white don't live in the neighborhoods that they police. They don't know the people. They don't know the culture. They come there with ideas like Little Black Sambo kind of thing, and that they're there to hold order and repress. That's what their job is. And they don't see people that they know. Like in their own communities, they see people as friends and neighbors. If they don't, as I said, most police don't live in the communities that they police. I think that would have a big difference on attitudes if policemen had to kind of live in districts that they police.
Right. Yeah. And that's been a demand of the civil rights movement for many years, that police sort of live in the neighborhoods that they work in.
Yeah.
And but with the intensity of the anti-crime campaign and the drugs and all that that came in,
that's get you elected.
Got intense with under Reagan, Ronald Reagan, that they hold as some kind of god among Republican circles, but who actually did grave damage to this country.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he's the one who introduced the anti-crime so-called policies that, in effect, were geared towards early mass incarceration of people of color and poor people in general, and gave the police carte blanche to use their weapons or deadly force however they felt like doing. So not enough to wound anybody. You got to kill them.
You got to kill. And know, something else that's come out that one argument that some police in some communities have used is that they don't see young black people as children or kids, even teenagers. Like this child's 12 years old, and that this one cop that shot and killed this kid, well, he looked like an adult to me. What 12-year-old do you know that basically looks like an adult, like you're equal? I don't know any. I know kids are big, but they still don't look like they're 40 years old.
Right. Sounds ridiculous.
Yeah.
But he saw color. He didn't see.
He didn't see this kid.
He didn't see a child. He saw color.
That's all. And this is something that's quite dangerous.
To be inculcated in police when they come in. And you know, the racist attitude's all over the place. But the point is, when you carry capital punishment at your side, and you are charged with, you have the right to take someone's life on the street, you need to not be racist. I mean, that's not a job for a racist. That's not a job for a woman hater.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a job for a violently, you know, psycho, violently type person.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't be hired for that. And they should really be profiled before they are hired in that position.
In that position.
That's how powerful it is to hold that position. You have life and death in your hands.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't be hired to do that. I just finished a pamphlet on Black Lives Matter, and that's one of the points I try to make. And it's in Michelle Alexander's really wonderful book, The New Jim Crow, and where she discusses how there was a whole psychological public campaign to shift the American people way over the right on issues of war and so forth, of crime and other issues.
Mm-hmm.
And to associate crime with people of color. And
hence we see where all of this involvement in the Middle East. You don't see any of this involvement in Europe. You don't even see this type of involvement as far as talking about racism. It certainly was in the Ukraine. I mean, in 1930s and 40s, when Hitler and Nazism was flourishing, you know, the Ukrainians were terrible. Their anti-Semitic policies were just a little short of the SS.
Well, there were elements who were pro-fascist who were there. But anti-Semitism had been in the Ukraine for, you know, hundreds
of years. Hundreds of years,
yeah. Yeah, it goes way back. And you can talk to some of the old Jewish families from Eastern Europe, and they would tell you, Ukraine, anti-Semitism was like racism in Mississippi, you know, very deep. And they were the one part of the old Soviet Union that welcomed the Nazis in.
Yes.
They literally welcomed them to come in.
And
some of those people are still around, and that's one of the forces who are involved. That's some of the forces who are involved now in the whole conflict with Russia, which is not all Russia's fault by any means. In fact, it's a provocation, really, to isolate the old Soviet Union.
That whole thing. That's something else it gets, because, you know, you talk to people like this guy. You ever watch MSNBC morning shows with that Joe Scarborough and
Morning Joe, yeah.
Yeah, and her brother was on one time. He was far more conservative than his father, the former not secretary, Zbigniew, yeah, who was terrible, you know. And And somebody was saying that if you gave him 3 tanks, he would invade Canada. But, you know, and I said, what really gets me is, it seemed to me as though there have been some of these people in our own government. I don't think President Obama has quite fallen into that trap, but tried as hard as they could, for every way they could, to try and get the Russians into some kind of war. And it seemed to me that what these people understand is, I don't know if the Russians would prevail or not, but I do know that if any bomb fell on Moscow, one would surely follow falling on New York City or Washington, D.C.
It's a war that nobody in their right mind would ever have.
No, but some of these right-wingers do.
Mm-hmm.
They think that this is a winnerable thing, that we can isolate them. And I forgot who said that we can just need to put a no-fly zone over Moscow. Are you insane?
Well, you remember Star Wars?
Yeah. Yeah, you really are.
It's an outer space-based missile system.
But, you know, and it really is really kind of frightening to think that there are many, many people, especially a lot of conservative people in the South and in the West, really sort of believe that. And I know it's because of the gun culture in the United States is so prevalent, but also the fact, other than Russia, that there always has to be, it seems our country always has to have an enemy. There always has to be somebody that they need to be at war with. And I think this has been prevailing since the, 1930s?
No, probably from the beginning. From the beginning of time, there's been some of that, but certainly in the beginning of modern capitalism, that kind of, rationale for war and aggression around the world has been used, and war and corporate profits have been joined at the hip.
Joined at the hip, yeah.
In terms of one systemic effort to gain more power and influence in the world by the few.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is that we have a world full of poverty and hunger and disease and, you know, people don't have health care and bad housing and so forth, that literally billions are suffering every day.
Now we have people down here in this country who also kick in race in there. Do you notice all of America's enemies usually live in Africa or Asia or in South America? They don't seem to live in Europe.
That's true. I mean, that is the image of the our adversaries, yes. People who we are opposed to and are opposed to us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yesterday they had a story about North Korea and that the North Korea general in charge of some kind of security or maybe the chief of staff or something was killed. Was killed because he fell asleep at a meeting. Now, North Korea is a tough cookie. I mean, frankly, I can't figure them out why they would do some of the things that they do, but I doubt that that's true. But that's the image to give you, that they're irrational, and therefore, you know, we need to have a great military power over that part of the world and be prepared to go to war. But the North Koreans have nuclear weapons, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think you cannot solve the world's problems with the nuclear option. It should be ruled out completely
in
world matters.
Right.
And I think we American people are big enough to understand that. Unfortunately, though, the dominant political forces here, particularly those on the extreme right, totally don't see that and don't want to see it.
You know, why do you think, I know back in the 30s when during the Great Depression eras, you know, the American workers were almost becoming, I don't think the word radicalized is the right word to use. But, you know, when you read history books, so you can look at things that were going on in this country in the 30s, really when things were very bad for American working people. And there were these huge parades, even with red banners, marching down Pennsylvania Avenue. And when Roosevelt came in, they thought what these new programs and ideas they would put forward was busy trying to save his class. He was busy trying to save capitalism because they was on the verge of being revolution in this country. Things were so bad. But when they instituted certain safety nets like Social Security, unemployment insurance, different other things, these are kind of like pacification things to keep Americans from becoming radicalized as a group against the ruling classes.
Well, I've heard that theory a lot, and this, I would have a little different angle on it.
Mm-hmm.
What the demand for welfare, mm-hmm. demand for unemployment compensation, demand for a social safety net came from working people who were suffering the terrible consequences of poverty and deprivation, mm-hmm. unemployment, long-term poverty, so forth.
These and natural disasters like what was pictured in the Grapes of Wrath.
It's true that part of what the powerful forces were thinking when they were finally forced to concede to some of these demands, what they were thinking was, well, if we don't do this, they're going to have a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue was, you know, revolution isn't so simple.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But and I wouldn't say it would have been a revolution, but it would have been a more democratic and a more egalitarian society that we would create,
mm-hmm.
that would have emerged if they didn't respond to this. But wait a minute, they did respond to it, and we did get a little more democratic and a little more egalitarian as a result.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to be careful that we don't think the worst the better, that if we suffer greater, they will do great things to overthrow the system. I think we've suffered enough.
Right.
I think we suffered enough. We paid a heavy price. We still got, you know, 45, 50 million people living in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
But still a whole bunch don't have health care. Still all these ill-housed and ill-fed people, mm-hmm. and they're constantly cutting these things. We've suffered enough. We don't need to suffer to recognize the necessity for change.
Right.
I think the biggest problem we have is that the agents of change, the political parties and so forth, mm-hmm. including those on the left particularly,
mm-hmm.
are not equipped, nor are they strong enough, nor are they their perceptions of how to make change deep enough, and I would say to effectively help to bring about that change.
Right.
And that's what we have to work on. How do we get a voice out there, a bigger voice, and a bigger size? The Communist Party is a small organization in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You recognize that. But we work in big politics,
mm-hmm.
and I think we say we're a minority party with a majority program.
Mm-hmm.
How to bring that to the American people in such a way. And you can see the American people has thinking has moved more to the left. That's why the right is so ferocious.
Well, they're saying, oh, no, we're a country that's...
They see people on agreeing with them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at the Republican candidates.
All 21 of them?
What an odd-looking bunch of fanatics,
mm-hmm.
you know? And to me... They think they're defending freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom for them may not be freedom for the rest of us, then, if that's what they think that is.
Right.
You know,
I agree 100% with that.
So I think we should hail what happened to New Deal. In fact, we need a new New Deal. We
mm-hmm.
call something else, but we need a new New Deal today. And not in any way say, oh, well, if we had accepted that reform, we would have had revolution. I don't think that's true.
No, well, I don't think.
And I'll tell you, the Communist Party did more to bring that change about
mm-hmm.
than any other political party in this period. And I'm telling you, our history and our take on history, we don't agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think a lot of people agree with that. I think that's something many people disagree with, you know, so I firmly believe that. Well, we're running down on our time. I have this calendar to do, but I have to ask you, on my next Saturday taping for TV, I hope to have you as one of my guests. We will be talking about some of the issues that we talked about today. We'll be primarily talking about racism and cops behaving badly all across the United States. And is this a new phenomenon or not? And particularly what we've been talking about, is there a police culture? Because many of the police doing bad things are African Americans and Latinos. And they seem to be heavily involved in the same culture.
Mm-hmm.
And we're wondering, why is that?
Well, not only that, sometimes they are pressured
mm-hmm.
even more so than the white cops
to conform.
They are loyal.
And part of the team.
That mm-hmm. are unwritten and written.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is black people are generally criminals, so that's what we have to be tough on, black people.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got to show you.
Except your family.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And this is not unusual to blacks. Remember the capos under Nazi Germany, many of those were Jewish.
Yes. But at the same time, what I'm trying to say, though, the great opposition of Jewish people was against fascism.
Yes.
They were fighting it. There were some people who were Jewish and who capitulated to that.
To that. Mm-hmm.
And compromised with that. And just like we have here with African Americans who capitulate and compromise, although... You know, we still voting the 90% against the Republicans. To me, that's a great measure.
Well, can I count on you to be one of my guests the next time I have a Saturday taping for TV?
Sorry?
Can I count on you to be one of my guests at the next Saturday taping for TV?
Well, you let me know when it is.
I will let you know. I will be on the phone with you when I get off the air and let you know.
Okay, wonderful.
Okay, we've been talking to Jarvis Tyner. He's based in New York City, and we'll be talking to him soon again. Buddy, good. See you later, and have a wonderful rest of the day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
As well. Bye-bye.
Now it's time for me to tell you a bit what's going on in Buffalo and Western New York on your community calendar. There were some things that I had to get in, although I enjoyed talking to my friend Jarvis. But I had to sort of tell you this. Muhammad School of Music, the weekend of, I guess it might be next weekend. Or, no, this weekend it's going to be. To be a part of this amazing event, it's a father and daughter virtuoso in concert. Experience electrifying violin and ballet performances by Professor, I should say, or Maestro Henri El Mohammed. And this is going to take place at 5 to 8 p.m. Let me just get the right date here if they give me the date. And they haven't sent me a date. But give them a call at 570-5064. 570-5064 and find out the exact date, which I don't have here in front of me. And this is some new information about jobs, accounts receivable, accounts payable. The job is a payable processor. The location is in Buffalo. The pay is $15 to $20 an hour. It's negotiable depending on experience. And that job order number is NY1130173, and you should call the Job Bank of Western New York, and their number is 851-2694. And there's also one here for Baker. The location is in Buffalo. I don't know what the pay is, but education required is simply a high school diploma. Experience required, they would consider a trainee. The job order number for that is NY1130168. And there is a social worker, but the deadline is coming up pretty soon. The location is in Niagara Falls. The pay is $29,000 to $32,000 a year. Health insurance allotment provided. Education, you need to have a bachelor's degree, and you need 2 years preferred experience. That job order number is NY1130191. And let me see, we may have time for one more, or we just have time for one more here. And this one is Insulation Installers. The location is in Lancaster. The pay is $10 through $16 an hour. It's negotiable depending on work experience. You need a high school diploma, vocational degree preferred. You need roofing experience, siding, and carpentry experience helpful. Willing to accept a trainee. That job order number is NY1128654. And that's it for me for today. Hope you stay with this station throughout your day.
You've been listening to The Mary Davis Show. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to Mary Davis, 500 Corporate Parkway, Suite 200, Amherst, New York, 14226.